Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
It's easy not to really notice bridges until they're icy, sewer lines until they clog, and levees until they flood. But America literally runs on infrastructure, and it's no accident that the 20th century, in which we became the world's most powerful economy, was also the one that saw unprecedented investment in highway construction, bridges, roads, tunnels, and utilities. But now a lot of those public goods are in disrepair. And without significant investment in repairing and enhancing them, some of that progress may reverse itself. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Already, the Texas A&M Transportation Institute estimates the economic cost of traffic congestion at $121 billion a year. And experts warn of dangerously diminished bridges, dams, and tunnels. So how did we build all this in the first place, and what will it take to restore these vital national assets? Henry Petrosky is professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University. His new book is called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Henry, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you.
We should start with this, that infrastructure is a deeply political issue, even when it doesn't seem very politically charged.
Well, that's certainly the way I see it. So much of infrastructure decisions really have to go through political bodies, state legislatures, even down to local municipalities and towns. And, of course, the federal government plays an overarching role in all of this, in setting standards and doling out money.
And as voters, you write that we make choices anecdotally. We assess what projects are and are not good investments of public capital according to what we use and what we see.
Well, that's right. There are something like 4 million miles of road in this country, and probably no one has ever driven over all of them. So we sample them, and often we sample mostly those in our neighborhoods, those in an area around which we live. And it's through those anecdotes that we form an opinion about the infrastructure, and we generalize about it the way we generalize about so much. And when it comes time to vote on representatives who are debating over whether we should support the infrastructure more or less, our experiences, our anecdotal experiences, really govern.
When roads are working for us, they appear to be just a flat ribbon of asphalt, but in fact, they're really complex machines. Can you tell us a little bit about the layers that go into a highway and how we settled on the design of roads that we use today?
Well, like so much technology, there's a long history of the development and research. Early roads didn't benefit from much science. They were more or less trial and error. And the French, the Romans, the English all played a role in the development of road technology as we know it. First, there has to be a solid foundation. Building a road through a swamp is obviously not a good idea. It's not going to last very long. So the foundation and then usually some kind of gravel in modern road building. Very often, concrete base will be put down, and over that, very often, asphalt. Nothing is totally standard. The asphalt, the finishing touch, is generally done because it provides the smoothest riding surface, which most people believe to be the true anecdotally again. As you know, probably everybody knows, concrete has to have seams. We're used to, you know, stepping over cracks lest we break our mother's back when we walk down the sidewalk. Well, if we drive over those sidewalks or roads like them, we have a repetitive click, click, click that is disturbing and makes the ride rougher than an asphalt road does, which has no seams.
We're so accustomed to striping on busy thoroughfares that it's easy to just assume, well, it's an obvious thing to do, but painting lines on roads was a pretty brilliant innovation.
Well, that's right. The earliest roads, and now we're talking about the early 20th century in the U.S., there were no markings on the roads. If they were paved, that was what made people happy. And what this meant that around curves, especially blind curves, there was quite a lot of confusion about where the car was coming and going, and a lot of collisions would naturally take place. Some fellow up in Michigan seems to have gotten the idea first of painting a line down the center of the road and advising people that they stay on their side of the line. It seems so elementary to us now, it's second nature, but it was revolutionary back then. And that was the birth of the center line, and at first it only appeared on curves and crests of hills. Now, of course, we expect it everywhere. And now this is pretty much governed by federal guidelines, and that's a good thing. And this is the role that the federal government plays that I think is to everyone's advantage, that wherever we drive in this country, we pretty much find the same markings on the roads. For a long time, it was debated whether that center line should be white or yellow when it was painted. And Oregon was one of the last holdouts for yellow line. But after the interstate highway system was established, the first standards were that it should be white. It was only later that it became yellow as we know it today. But it's wonderful when you're driving from one state into another that the colors of the lines don't change arbitrarily. Otherwise, it would be very confusing driving, especially in poor lighting conditions and poor visibility conditions. So yes, that was a quite a good innovation. The sideline, the edge of the road on the right, that solid line that we find on interstates all over the country is another very helpful device. Keeps us from drifting off onto the shoulder, especially helpful when the shoulder is soft and mushy during heavy rainstorms.
There was lots of debate in the beginning of the time that we had not just interstate highways, but, you know, long distance roadways, what color the signage should be. And now it's so standardized, it's green and white, and that's what we expect. But that wasn't a foregone conclusion.
Well, that's right. Early signs were pretty much local self-help things. People would put up signs on a curve that they knew that the local drivers had trouble with. But it wasn't really until the interstates again were established that really standardization became very, very well established. There was some standardization before the interstates, but it was after the interstates that the idea of visibility of signs came to the fore, especially in connection with the realization that the population generally is aging, that therefore drivers are aging, and their visibility, their vision is not as good as it once was. So the visibility of signs was, you know, something to really be concerned about. And there was an effort to develop a specific typeface to be more easily read, especially by older people driving at interstate speeds, meaning 65, 70 miles per hour, and signs that they could not get confused about, because with the old typeface that was being used on signs, certain letters could look like other letters. An I could look like an L, and we've all experienced that with email, I believe. And some of the letters like E and O and A, they would fill in and get blurry under certain conditions, especially bad lighting conditions. So there was a typeface developed called Clearview, and it actually has been under development and being used, but not in an obligatory way. The states were allowed to use it by the Federal Highway Administration. There's a very interesting development just happened within the last few weeks. The Federal Highway Administration posted a notice in the Federal Register that typeface is no longer going to be even allowed. And it's odd because it is clearer. Apparently, what's behind this, in part at least, is that states have to pay to license that typeface because it's made by a particular, well, they used to call them type foundries, but now everything's digitized. And what's going to happen is not clear, but it might be that the government will develop a a typeface that'll be in the public domain so that it can be used without having to pay a license fee.
Maybe everybody knew this except me, Henry, but your book has given me a tip that I will use for the rest of my life. There are clues as to whether interstate highways go north to south or east to west in their numbering.
Yes. When I first learned about that some years ago, I said, boy, that's obvious now that I know it.
Exactly.
I've been driving on these roads for so long, and why didn't I pick up on this? But north-south roads are odd-numbered. East-west roads are even-numbered. It actually predates the interstate highway system. It goes back to the U.S. highways. Those are the ones that are the, they have a shield with black on white numbering system. The U.S. highways, we call them. So we'd refer to U.S. 1 or U.S. 40. those started that system. And I say those. What I should say is there is such an organization called the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. That is a group of the states plus the District of Columbia, the directors of transportation in those states. They carry different titles, and they get together as a group and advise and set standards that they follow, that they used to follow voluntarily. Now the federal government has taken over this obligation. But these are not just willy-nilly decisions. They are well considered by groups that, have a stake in the game. But yes, the highway system, the numbering system for the U.S. highways goes one way. U.S. 1 is on the East Coast, and then the numbers increase as you go west. In the interstate system, the lower numbers are on the West Coast, and they progress upward to the east. So Interstate 95, for example, is up the East Coast. In the south, the interstate highways are like Interstate 5, Interstate 10 would be an east-west. Up north, Interstate 80 or Interstate 90 would be an east-west. And the U.S. highways are just the opposite, from low to high, north to south.
And when there are three numbers in a road, what does that mean?
Well, if you're driving along an interstate, sometimes there's a beltway that goes around a large city, or a spur that goes off in a certain direction. Those are branches of a trunk, the trunk being the main interstate highway. So we're in Dallas-Fort Worth now, I believe. You have Interstate 85, so you might have a 385, which would be connected to 85. If you go off on 385 and you continue on it, you'll probably come back to 85. And on the East Coast, which I'm more familiar with, on Interstate 95, you go up around Washington, D.C., and you'll hit 495, which is a ring road around Washington area. There are also 295s. 295s just go off and connect small roads. So if you get off Interstate 95, you get on 295, you'll end up on the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. Further up the coast, you encounter other 295s, but there's usually no chance of confusion because they're in widely dispersed cities.
Henry Petrosky is my guest. He's professor of history and of civil engineering at Duke University and has a new book out called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Welcome back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
We're spending less on fixing our infrastructure than China is, than Germany is. All our competitors, they know we've got to start taking care of this stuff. We're lagging behind. And the irony is, right now, it's cheaper to build than it's been since the 1950s. You've got a whole bunch of construction workers who are looking for work right now. You've got a whole bunch of contractors who will come in with low bids, and they'll come in on time. So now's the time for us to do it. The longer we put this off, the more expensive it will be, the less competitive we'll be. So why aren't we doing it? Now, part of it's just politics right now, but, you know, making sure we've got world-class infrastructure, that shouldn't be a partisan issue. That's an American issue. It's not a Republican or a Democratic issue.
That was President Obama speaking in 2013. We're speaking this hour with a civil engineer and historian, Henry Petrosky of Duke University. His new book is called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Henry, what has been the result of all the money earmarked for infrastructure as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act?
Well, that's actually still somewhat of a debated point. The act, I think it was almost $1 trillion, if I recall. It was $800 or $900 billion. Those in the construction industry claim that about $150 billion at most went to construction and infrastructure projects. And you might remember that the so-called shovel-ready projects that were advertised that were going to let us get up and going so quickly really didn't seem to be materialized. That's because it takes quite a bit of planning for these projects. The idea of shovel-ready is a mystery to a lot of people, where that term actually came from. There have to be all sorts of agreements among the interested parties, the stakeholders, if you will, about, you know, how you're going to close a road to work on it, what are the restrictions going to be. This takes time, and it takes planning. Very seldom can you suddenly work on a road and get it done within months. It literally does take years, as we mostly know when we drive around highways. Coming in under budget can be done. Coming in before schedule, that's less common.
How are the costs of roads divided up among federal, state, and local governments?
Well, that's a good question. And let me start by saying a little bit about the gas tax. When we buy a gallon of gasoline, we pay a tax. And that tax is federal in part, state in part, and sometimes municipal in part. The federal gasoline tax has been set at 18.4 cents a gallon since 1993, and that's been a point of some discussion since then, because that means that it's not keeping up with inflation and needs. That's the federal end, and all of that money is supposed to go into what's called a highway trust fund, and that highway trust fund is to be spent only on highways and bridges, and there's a little else that can be spent on relating to transportation, but the big bulk of it is roads and bridges. So if a state wants to work on an interstate project, let's say they want to widen it, and that would usually mean they'd also have to redo the bridges, they can apply to the federal government for a certain amount of the cost, and the federal government will take that into consideration and will award the money if there is money, and also if the project conforms to federal standards. Now, this is one of the reasons, by the way, why projects take so long and they're not shovel-ready. There has to be this anticipation of this problem. This accounts for about 25% of what we spend on roads and bridges. Of the other three-quarters, that's about evenly divided roughly between state departments of transportation and municipalities or townships. And the states tax gasoline also. And in many states, in fact, in most states, the tax that they impose, levy, is more than the federal tax. And lately, it's a very big moving target for a variety of reasons. A principal one is that the revenue from the gas taxes, the various gas taxes, is just not keeping up with needs. And the main reason for that is people are just not buying as much gasoline as they used to. And that's a counterintuitive thing. You know, we have more cars, we're driving more. So what's happening? Well, automobiles, vehicles generally have gotten more fuel efficient. Well, that means, of course, that if you drive the same amount, you don't need as much gasoline. So you don't buy as much, you don't contribute as much to this trust fund. But also, we've seen the government encouraging hybrid automobiles, all-electric automobiles. All electrics, of course, don't use gasoline at all, and therefore no tax revenue. Hybrids use a little bit of gasoline, but not nearly as much as they would if they were not hybrids. So this has made the balance of revenue and expenditures a very, very complicated moving target from year to year. The federal government passed an act last December that seemed to be a step in the right direction. It was for 5 years. This was something new. This would make highway and highway planning long-term much easier for the states, and they could, you know, get ahead of things. But unfortunately, the federal government, through the legislature, principally the Congress, did not raise the gasoline tax. So that's still a problem. States are scrambling to keep up because ultimately they're the ones that own the roads. The federal government does not own any of the roads. The Constitution doesn't authorize the federal government to own roads. They can, of course, dole out money as they do and make standards, but they can't build the roads themselves. Now, because of this problem with the gasoline tax not keeping up with needs, there have been proposals and to go to an alternative system. And, well, there are basically two alternative systems. One is for the federal government to get out of the business altogether and let the states do it themselves. They'll be able to respond more quickly, and they'll be the masters of their own destiny. So all the taxes would be state taxes. They're not totally keen about that because that means, you know, that you don't have to think about where to point the finger when your gas price goes up. The other is to recognize that people are just not using and not buying as much gasoline. And what we should really do is somehow tax people or charge them a fee for how many miles they drive with their vehicles. Because after all, that's what wears out the roads, the distance that you drive over them, the frequency with which you drive, and so forth. That's being experimented with in several states right now. Oregon and California has started on a small program. And the idea is probably going to take years, if not a decade or so, to get fully implemented, and it probably will be eventually. But there are questions of privacy. How are you going? Who's going to measure how far you drive? And if they're going to measure how far you drive, they're probably going to know where you drive, and that's a privacy issue. And you can appreciate that. This will be a topic of discussion for, I think, some years, and everybody really has a stake in it. So we should all follow this because eventually it may impact the races like the presidential race or local congressional races. And it might also appear on our ballots as bond issues about how we're going to pay for roads and so forth. And, of course, if we're going to pay for them, we have to have a way to raise the revenue. And so this issue may actually come up for a vote.
Before we move on from this, Texas charges 20 cents in taxes per gallon of gasoline sold. California, Hawaii, Connecticut charge more than twice that. Do states with higher gasoline taxes tend to have better roads?
Not necessarily. I don't think there's a direct correlation there. Part of the reason for the different state taxes is, you know, what will the citizens bear? Part of it is that in some states, the taxes that are charged on fuel are actually, the revenue from that is actually diverted to other uses. There are a whole variety of reasons. So it's hard to generalize, you know, about the 50 states.
Okay, Henry, I'm very excited to have you on because I've always wanted to know how, let's just say municipalities, make decisions about where road maintenance happens over time and how often. I recognize that, you know, people can call in if they see a big pothole somewhere and eventually somebody gets out there. But in terms of the resurfacing that seems to happen on streets, how are those plans set out so that it's done in an orderly fashion in any given city?
Well, I think it's, again, it's hard to talk about it in absolute general terms. It'll vary from municipality to municipality. But the basic issue is this. When a road is paved, newly paved, you could expect it to last for a certain number of years, 10, 15, 20 years. And how long it lasts will depend on how well it's done, how well the work is done in the first place. And that could depend on what was the temperature on the day in which the asphalt was put down, for example. Hmm. If it was too cold, the asphalt just won't take the way it would if it were a warmer day, and so forth. So although the contractor or the person selling the asphalt might say, well, this is going to be a 15-year road, that could be not exactly the true length of time. So planning becomes very difficult. You can't say and you can't budget that, okay, that road that we've just surfaced, in 15 years from now, we're going to redo it. Because 15 years from then, it might be a totally crumbly mess. Or if it was done especially well and it was kept up well, it might last for 20 years, let's say, in which case maybe you shouldn't go and resurface it then. There might be other roads that, you know, are better. In an honest administration with honest, you know, bureaucrats, they would look at the issue and weigh, you know, the various requests, let's say, for roads. And believe me, they get lots of requests. People say the road in front of my house needs work more than the road in front of my neighbor's house. You know, it might even be the same road. So it really boils down to a political decision again, and it may not be a decision made absolutely by elected officials. It may be made by bureaucrats. The New England system of townships, where the citizens tend to vote on each line item in a budget, generally are kept more honest, I would say, in that each decision, and here we're talking about a much smaller scale too, so this kind of thing can work. But even in larger cities, there are such things as, you know, hearings and weekly meetings or discussions that might take place informally in the letters to the editor columns in the local papers. The citizens do have an opportunity to take part in these discussions, but as with so many other things, the squeaky wheel tends to get the most grease. The only solution to this kind of thing that I can see is for everybody, for all citizens, to recognize that in a way it's their duty as citizens to let the local government officials and bureaucracy know when some things need work. It used to be in the U.S., say a century ago, that roads were not nearly as sophisticated as they are now, but you had an option as a citizen. You could either pay taxes, and a portion of those taxes would go to hire people to fix up the roads, or you could volunteer to do work on the roads yourself. And you could go out there and, you know, you'd be issued a rake or a hoe or whatever and level out the dirt road or smooth out the gravel. that didn't survive, and nobody really does that anymore, in large part because the quality of the work was hard to control, as you can imagine. But, of course, infrastructure is not just in these public works. Our private driveways, our private property, we often take care of ourselves. And as people know and observe, some pieces of property are better taken care of than others. So it's sort of a microcosm. How we take care of our own little homestead, if you will, is representative of how the different municipalities and different states can ostensibly be doing the same job, but come to a different conclusion and a different result.
The story of traffic signals is surprisingly fascinating, and this is an innovation that is less than a century old.
That's right. Yeah, we're about a century from the first traffic signals. Yeah, there are so many aspects to it, it's hard to know where to begin. Even, you know, what the colors should be and, you know, how they should be arranged and so forth. But it actually predates automobiles and trucks. Even going back to horses and wagons in larger cities especially, there were traffic jams, there was gridlock, there was congestion. But then when automobiles became more and more common in the 19-teens especially, the problem became completely exacerbated. And there was a fellow in New York City who came from a pretty well-to-do family who had a lot of, I would say, you know, leisure time that he could observe traffic in a rather analytical way. And he did. His name was William Phelps Eno. And he realized that there had to be some way of organizing traffic. And he realized that that could be done with signs and other means of control devices.
All right, I'm going to jump in here and take a break so you can finish the story in just a moment. My guest is Henry Petrosky. He's professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University. His book is called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Professor of History and of Civil Engineering at Duke, Henry Petrosky, author of The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Before the break, Henry, you were telling us about William Phelps Eno, who is the kind of nerd that we very much love on this show. He became obsessed with the problems of traffic congestion.
Well, yes, he did. And one of the things that he instituted was driving on the right side of the road, something which, again, seems so elementary to us now. But some of the first traffic signs to be erected anywhere, in this country at least, basically told drivers to stay on this right side of the road except when passing. And, you know, these are the kind of signs we see on the interstates and highways all over the country now. But he also wrote little booklets and published them at his own expense, with rules of the road, how to make turns, do the things that are, well, now we might find them on a driver's license test when we're looking for our learner's permit in particular. So he was very instrumental. And there is an Eno Transportation Foundation established based in Washington, D.C., that is still interested in transportation research, and it's his legacy. But the traffic lights that we were talking about, the first traffic lights that we would recognize as such were actually manually operated by a policeman who stood next to them and threw the switches to change the red light to the green and so forth. Visibility was always a problem, and safety of the policeman who was doing this changing. So early traffic signals began to be raised in towers, and they called them signal towers. And again, they were manually operated, but the advantage of them was that the policemen up in the crow's nest, if you will, could see traffic developing for blocks, and as a result, could anticipate problems. The question of coordination soon became difficult, of course, and the way this was handled at first was visually a string of these traffic towers down a main avenue or boulevard would have a policeman in the particular location, and they would, by signaling each other, control the signals to coordinate them. The introduction of automatic signals was a real boom because basically a city didn't have to devote so much of its police force to traffic control. New York City in about the late 1920s began to signalize its intersections with a lot of automatic traffic signals, and they saved literally tens of millions of dollars a year that they didn't have to pay policemen for doing that service. Fifth Avenue in New York, which is, of course, a very famous shopping street, high-end stuff, they didn't want these ugly traffic towers because the early ones were rather functional and stick structures. They had a national design competition among architects to design something that was, well, what the Fifth Avenue merchants thought fitting for, you know, their setting. And these were pretty elaborate, but it soon became clear that they were also obstructions to traffic. As traffic volume increased, having these things in the middle of the road was not a good thing. You were basically taking out a whole lane where they were located. So that's when a city like New York, at least, got its traffic lights changed from towers to the familiar ones that we see in smaller cities today, of a little traffic signal at the corner standing on a pole. This was an interesting development. Through the 20s and 30s and even into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was quite a evolution about whether the traffic signals should have three lights, red, yellow, and green, or two, just red and green. And it had to do with how the yellow light operated, and that's still actually a controversial topic even today. In New York for quite a while, the yellow light came on to signal that the green light was about to come on.
Oh, bad idea.
So, of course,
very bad idea.
Yeah, as you can see immediately, right? So for a while in New York, the yellow light was banned entirely because automobiles were taking off at the yellow instead of waiting for the green, as should have been anticipated. And, of course, this created a lot of traffic collisions. Even should the red light be on top or the green on top was an issue in certain locations.
Including Syracuse, New York, right?
I was just going to mention Syracuse, New York, which has a large Irish-American population. And, of course, green is the color of the Irish. And they saw red as the color of the British. And so the Irish, they certainly weren't going to welcome in their neighborhood traffic signals that had the British color over the Irish color. They wanted the green on top. And they, to this day, there are signals in Syracuse with the green on top. Now, of course, for those of us who can distinguish between red and green, it's an oddity. Maybe it doesn't matter. But about 10% of males, male drivers, can't distinguish between red and green because they're colorblind. So for those drivers, the position of the light is extremely important. They can tell it's red because it's the top light that's lit. And we forget little things like that when we accommodate certain special interest groups. It can create quite a chaotic mess after a while. So the traffic light has had a very interesting history. Today, there is I won't say a burning issue, but a controversial issue that some people actually expect to go to the Supreme Court someday. And that is, how long should the yellow light be? Now, of course, today the yellow light signals that the red is going to come on, and you should be prepared to stop. Well, of course, when you see that yellow come on, you have the decision as a driver. Do I have room enough to stop, or do I have room enough to get through the intersection? And this certain area, if you are close enough to the light but not too close, is called the dilemma zone. Hmm. It's not clear which way you can go. There are some people who claim that some cities, some municipalities, deliberately make that yellow light interval short so that police can give out a lot more tickets for your being in the intersection when the red light comes on. And this has become especially a hotly debated topic with this new concept of cameras that take a picture of you going through the intersection on the red, the so-called red light cameras. And these automatically send you a ticket and say for $100, and you know, it can mean tens of millions of dollars of revenue per year for larger cities. Well, anyway, as I say, these kinds of issues are being taken to court, and the whole question of how the setting of the yellow interval is determined has become a topic of politics rather than of technology, depending on how fast the speed limit is and distances and so forth and so on.
I have thought more than once in the past that I wish there were an intercom between automobiles so that I could, you know, give another driver a piece of my mind. It's probably a good thing that I wasn't able to do that, or they to me. But in the future, when you look ahead at innovations, you say it may very well be that automobiles at least are able to communicate with one another.
Yes, the automobiles will more likely communicate, silently among each other. Idea of an autonomous automobile or a self-driving automobile is really upon us already. People like Google and automobile manufacturers, they believe they've already got that technology pretty much perfected. The problem, again, boils down to one of public policy and definition. If there's no driver in the car, who's responsible if there's an accident? And this is a debate that's probably going to go on for years and possibly even decades. And in the meantime, the technology is ready to go. It's reminiscent of a little bit of the Segway, if you recall this Segway, which you stood up on. It was like a scooter, but you just leaned forward and it went. The question arose when that came out, could it ride on sidewalks? Was it a vehicle or not? And it all boiled down to a matter of definition. And a lot of cities and municipalities passed laws banning it from sidewalks. And this threw a whole monkey wrench into the hopeful, successful enterprise of selling these things. I think we're in that stage now with the so-called self-driving or autonomous vehicles. But there's little question, I think, that we will see them before too long.
How would self-healing concrete work, and how long would it take to pay, like for the additional expense up front, to pay for itself in the form of fewer repairs?
Well, the way it can work, and there are variations on this, but you could embed in concrete when you're forming it, mixing it, little capsules that might contain certain dormant bacteria, let's say, and if the concrete develops a crack, that would let water seep in, and that water then would reach these capsules, and it could dissolve the capsule and awaken or release, activate the bacteria inside. And these bacteria could exude some kind of a healing agent that would seal up the crack. That'd be one way it could be done. There's talk of also self-healing asphalt, in which case there would be embedded in it, mixed in it again, as you would prepare it, little fibers, maybe fibers like of steel wool or something, that if the asphalt wants to start cracking up, you could drive over it with something that would send microwaves out, and this would generate heat among these filaments, and that would bring the asphalt back together. These are things that are, I guess I would say, in the research stage right now, but they have been demonstrated on a small scale. It's always a question of technology, how long it's going to take to take something from the laboratory where it works on a small scale and bring it up to a large scale where you can, in this case, talk about, you know, a whole self-healing road or bridge. That, I don't think we're there quite yet.
In the book, you estimate the cost at about $150 trillion by 2040 if we keep sort of patching our infrastructure problems rather than fully repairing and replacing it. That's a lot of money.
It is. One of the things about infrastructure is the money's never going to be, it's never going to be totally paid for in the sense that we're going to have the infrastructure fixed forever because every component of the infrastructure is going to have a lifetime, whether it's 50 years for a bridge or 20 years for a roadway that's paved. Every 20 years or 50 years or so forth, we're going to have to repeat those expenditures. And with inflation, with time, the money is going to just increase. The only way to get ahead of this, in my opinion, is to do it right the first time and recognize, be honest about it, that this is not a one-time expenditure, but this is just a first installment. And if we do it right this time, the future installments may not be as difficult to meet. But any responsible budget has to include maintenance. It's just like if you own a house, you have to maintain it. You should recognize that you're going to have to paint it every so many years, 10, 15 years, depending in part on the paint you use and in part on the climate in which your house is located. These are the realities. People don't live forever. We shouldn't expect our infrastructure to live forever either.
Do you think the gas tax will live forever at 18 cents on the gallon?
No, I think there's going to be a change. I think the federal gas tax may be a thing of the past within another few administrations, and I think the states will have the total responsibility for that part of the infrastructure.
Henry Petrosky is professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University, and he's author of a new book called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Henry, it's been very interesting talking with you. Thank you for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you. It was very interesting for me, too.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.